So hello and welcome back to the second part of this overheating lecture about waste. So in the first part of the lecture I gave a global overview of some indicators of growth in waste. I introduced a few theoretical tools helping us to make sense of the phenomenon of waste and asking, you know, to what extent can something which is considered waste or rubbish or garbage be converted into something of value. And we also made a trip to Addis Ababa and the big rubbish dump of Koshi, where people make a precarious living on a shoestring, recycling and trying to make use of waste in different ways, which also shows in Caroline Knowles' analysis, especially towards the end of her article, the transnational connections that the rubbish dump can tell you about, and of overheated globalization owing to the massive export of plastics from China, many of which find their way eventually to Koshi in Addis Ababa. So now we'll move on to talk about waste from a couple of other perspectives, adding some more theoretical depth to the analysis of waste and overheating. So waste can also be seen, and inevitably is so, I guess, as a metaphor for people who don't fit in. This is already present in Douglas's initial analysis, although she's not so concerned, certainly not in that book, with the people who are outside, the people who are excluded, who are considered, as it were, human waste. But Zygmunt Bauman, who left us a few years ago, very important social theorist and sociologist, born in Poland, a professor at the University of Leeds, wrote a book at the beginning of this century called Wasted Lives, where he somehow takes some of Mary Douglas's ideas and refers to her and builds an analysis around exclusion, superfluity, people who don't have any, as it were, value to governments or corporations and so on, and who are in the way, talking about poor people in the global south, refugees, some minorities, and others who somehow don't fit in and who are therefore excluded. So that's another, I think, very powerful way of thinking about waste, which has been developed also in an article that I wrote with Katrine Thorleifsson, whom you also meet in the course of this overheating course. She was a postdoc, like Astrid Stensrud and Elizabeth Schrober, on overheating. And we wrote an article together on the two kinds of gypsies, Roma gypsies and the travellers, known sometimes as Tatare, sometimes as Reisne, depending on the context, in Northern Europe, and the way in which they are associated with waste. I mean, the Roma gypsies who leave waste behind, you know, when they move from one campsite to another, but who are also in the way. They don't fit into our classificatory system. They're an embarrassment because they're poor, they beg, they are in some ways considered, I think, by many Norwegians as human waste. And Katrine Thorleifsson has massive documentation of ways in which Roma gypsies are considered human waste. She's been following debates in the newspapers, I mean in the press, but also in the social media about Roma, and shows that in fact there's a lot of anti-Ziganism simmering in this country. Anti-Ziganism, you know, negative stereotypes and prejudices against gypsies. I'm saying gypsy, some say Roma, but you know, there are different, several categories of gypsies. Roma are the largest ones, and they're certainly the predominant one here, but there are also other. There are Sinti, and there are Kala, there are several gypsy groups, and this is why I'm saying gypsies. Anyway, impure people, people who are sort of at the low end, as it were, of the social hierarchies, exist in complex societies where there is a system for rubbish collecting and the disposal of waste. And it goes back, you know, there were systems for the disposal of waste in Roman times, even in Mesopotamia. So all cities produce waste and you didn't know what to do with it. As late as the mid-19th century, people who lived in blocks of flats in apartment buildings in cities like New York, they might just throw out the slops, throw out the waste out of the window. So kids could make a penny or two by, if they had a shovel, okay, and they could shovel the waste away to create paths, footpaths, for people who didn't want to soil their clothes on their way to work. So clearly this got to a head at a certain point, and you got in place the beginnings of what we now know as a municipal waste disposal system. You know that the public sector, in fact, is responsible for the disposal of waste. And as I mentioned in the overheating book, somewhere, Fresh Kills, which was the largest rubbish dump or landfill in the US and indeed in the world, was described by some as being larger, at least in volume, than the Great Wall of China. It was closed down in 2001, people have been working on it in various ways, you know, not digging up all the waste, but adding soil, planting trees. It is being opened these days at this part of Fresh Kills, which is on Staten Island in New York, right? It's a short ferry ride from Manhattan. Being developed into a very, rather nice green recreational area with, you know, ice cream vendors and footpaths and benches where you can sit and watch the sunset and so on. So that is one example, which I think is an interesting one, of the ways in which waste can be turned into value. But the binman, the night soil man, not man, as we said in Norwegian, had a very stigmatizing job, and they were considered in many cities as virtually low caste. It was hard for them to get godparents for the children when they were to be baptized, because you didn't want to be associated with a night soil man, because it might be polluting, you know, it could pollute you. So they were to some extent endogamous. They married each other. They lived, many of them lived in a secluded part, in a particular part of the city, so that they had minimal contact with others, and went out to do their filthy job at night so that respectable citizens didn't have to think about the work that they did. There's a street in Oslo, a long street called Pilstredet, which means the willows street, or the willows path, really. Stredet is a narrow street. And in the past, in the 19th century, it was known as Rakkerstredet. And the Rakker was the night soil man. It was the local term for the night soil man. And it led up to an area which is now, I mean, at Adamstuen, okay, which is now not very far from the university, and of a completely different order. And that was where they had their houses and their animals and their settlements. So waste is contagious. That's the point. You associate yourself with waste and you become somehow not wasted, but you become polluted by the waste. Joshua Reno, who's an American anthropologist who's been looking at municipal workers, renovation workers, he says that they have an obsession with cleanliness. You enter into their house and there isn't a speck of dust to be seen anywhere. And some of them say to him things like, you know, I wash and I wash and I take long hot showers, but it is as if I never get rid of the smell. It somehow has seeped into my skin. That's the feeling they have, that they are polluted and no matter what you do, they will remain so. So don't tell me that being a binman cannot be stigmatizing. But it doesn't have to be that way. And one interesting thing that has happened in the renovation business in the last, I say, 20 years, I've been following this for about 20 years, is the attempt to shift the identity of rubbish disposal in this part of the world, but also elsewhere, from something that is unclean and that you'd rather not think about and that respectable people would prefer, you know, not to know too much about, to being at the vanguard of the public environmental movement. So you see this truck, this lorry, which is about to empty its contents into a recycling station. What it says on the side of the truck is Verdi Transport. It basically means, I mean, transportation of valuable goods. Right? Verdi Transport is a term in Norwegian which is usually used about you know, bullion. You know, if you carry gold or other very sort of valuable stuff that make you vulnerable to robbers, highway robbers and that sort of thing. It's Verdi Transport. So that's a bit of a joke. And for a while, they had a slogan in the municipal renovation service in Oslo, which ran, rubbish doesn't exist, only values or valuables gone astray. Søppel finnes ikke bare verdier på avveie, only valuables gone astray. And I happen to know that one of the people who was sort of running the shop at the time, he had read Murray Douglas. Yeah. He knew what this was about, that you could redefine it. So the dream of recycling everything that we find in the renovation business in the global north, but also in the global south. As I mentioned in writing in the previous slide, there is a biofuel plant at Kosher. You know, you can produce biofuels, the ammonium. Okay, that is generated by household waste, by rotting vegetables and similar things. So the dream of recycling everything is a powerful one, producing a circular enemy. So I say breaking the spell of the destruction of the fossil fuel capitalist system. When I did research for my book on waste, I went to one of those recycling stations, one of the largest ones, just outside of Oslo, between Oslo and the airport. It's a very large recycling station. And so I had made an appointment, I introduced myself, and the man who was taking me around, he was a friendly guy, you know, in one of those sort of fluorescent jackets. And I said, so, it's good to be here. I'm looking forward to having a good look at your rubbish. And he sort of looked sternly at me and said, rubbish, we don't have any rubbish here. And then he sort of expansively made a wave with his right arm and said, these are resources. Going on to rattle off, you know, the 24 different fractions into which they classified their resources. Anything from lacquered wood, you know, to metals and so on. So the aim is that nothing should be left on the landfill. That which cannot be recycled is being burnt and turned into electricity. Okay, but to keep in mind that a lot of waste is, is this a solution to overheating? Well, I'm running ahead of myself. Keep in mind that much of the waste produced in the world, it's not plastic wrappers. It's not banana peel. It's not single-use diapers that if you have a baby, I mean, we used to have a huge container upstairs, you know, in the bathroom that we filled up with plastic diapers when my kids were at that age. So it's not that, it's industrial waste. I mean, from construction, on construction sites, enormous amounts of rubbish. Much of it doesn't affect climate much, not directly, doesn't even seep into the soil and contaminate it. Some of it does. Nuclear waste is one big headache, you know, for people who are favorable to nuclear power. What to do with the nuclear waste? How can we be sure that it, you know, remains, you know, encapsulated and safe for millennia? But much of the waste from industry is not contaminated. It's not like the Bhopal disaster. It's not like mine tailings. Although this is part of the story, much of it is just ugly. Okay, just ugly. So keep that in mind. I mean, we shouldn't exaggerate. But is this a solution to overheating? I'm just raising the question. A circular economy. Is it possible? Is it feasible? And could renovation, the new logic of renovation as recycling rather than discarding, could that be a way of beginning? Could that be a place to begin? Because it's respectable, it's politically supported, I think, by all political parties in most countries. I mean, the US still has a lot of landfills, and incineration, that is burning of rubbish, is also quite common in countries like the UK, so by all means. The ideology of recycling everything feels good, you know, it sounds good. So maybe that is the place to begin if you want to do something about overheating. Anyway, let's move on to another story from the opposite side of Africa. This is from Ghana, from Tema, which is just east of Accra. It's almost grown into, I mean, there's almost a continuous urban sort of stretch from Tema to Accra. And Brenda Chalfin has done comprehensive long-term fieldwork in that area, looking among other things at recycling and at the communities that grow up around recycling. And she also, in her article and elsewhere in other things she's written, she also somehow confirms some of these statements or points that were made by Caroline Knowles when she wrote about Addis Ababa and about the city in general, and the city and the rubbish dump, that it is a place for encounters, it's a place for it's a crossroads, it's a and it's a fluid place where you have to negotiate your own sort of whereabouts and your identity and whatever it is that you do all the time, because you don't have an office to go to every morning, or you don't have a construction site where they've employed you and they give you all sorts of social benefits, and you don't even run a shop. You're on your own if you belong to that African precariat, as these recyclers in Tema do. And the way in which she shows, I mean, she does it in many ways, but one way in which she shows the Tema as a sort of as a meeting place, okay, as a place of encounters, but also a place of frictions in an overheated country where many people have no place to go, so they end up in the poorer parts of a suburb of Accra, is that you get gangs, you get ethnic tensions, you get hierarchies. Didn't I say something about this? Oh, sorry. I wanted you to look at the other image more carefully. This is from the market, okay? You get hierarchies. Yeah, this is another image from this area, and in fact, this area is called Ashaiman. And this is an image from the surrounding areas of the overhead bridge. And one of the people says, one of the workers who's been interviewed by an online newspaper called Ashaiman Online says, "We can't even breathe when we come to work, not to talk of eating any good meal. We just can't stand the odour. I see people dumping refuse here often, and when I query any of them, they ask whether the place belongs to my father." So, rubbish disposal is patchy. People dump stuff, and there are no sort of visible sanctions. Which also says something. I mean, the way in which people dispose of their waste, it also says something about the way society is organized. But also, keep that in mind, the degree of informality also comes into this. So I'm not saying that one man's waste is another man's value. That would be romanticizing waste. But I'm saying that the very fluidity, the fact that suddenly you have this area, or you have this area where people dump things, it also opens up for opportunities for people who have the skills and the possibilities to produce value from this waste. So she writes about, I mean, Chalfin writes about internal hierarchies and ethnicity, as I briefly mentioned, and but the wider framework is the lack of a formal labour market, the fact that there aren't any jobs as such, but you have to make a living, so you do it wherever you can. She also has some really nice description of some of the stuff that she finds. So here we are, looking at the things that she finds on the dump, reflecting the diets of Ashaiman residents along with the values, work schedules and aspirations. There are tomato tins, ranging in size from single serving to extra large, sardine and mackerel cans, corned beef containers, empty bottles and jugs for cooking oil, milk and Milo tins, soft drink cans and bottles. in addition to countless plastic water bottles already reused many times. So how can you make a living of this? Well, you can make tourist souvenirs of the mackerel tins, I suppose. You can, you know, you can make funny things of soft drink cans. You know, we've seen this in some countries. So where scarcity is a recipe for creativity, because you simply have to do something. So anyway, that's a story from a shaman. Connect that with Caroline Knowles if you're going to write about waste at some point. If you're interested in waste, connect that with Caroline Knowles. And if you want to make some wide-ranging comparisons, compare this to the sort of the well-organized public municipal handling of waste that we're accustomed to in Northern Europe, and the attempts to transform rubbish into something valuable. Zygmunt Bauman, never an optimist, but a very wise man, says that waste is a dark, shameful secret of all production. And it is obvious. You know, on the one hand, you have the Mary Douglas thing with the purity and impurities of the body, cleanliness, uncleanliness, and the cleanliness, uncleanliness of society, reflecting each other. But on the other hand, you have the sort of the psychological approach to waste, which you find, for example, in a great novel by the American writer Don DeLillo called Underworld, where the main character, he works with waste disposal, and he even works with nuclear waste disposal. And in him, you can see how his work, you know, digging holes, covering them up, sealing that shameful residue of nuclear power, sealing it up, how that is reflected in his own mind. This is a psychoanalytical, or you know, at least psychological approach. His own mind has his own shameful secrets and its dark recesses and its subconscious, which you don't want to access until you want to, and its horrors and its fears. This is what Bauman says. But, you know, waste, yes, we know what we're talking about. It's a side effect. It's the most obvious side effect. I mean, as I said, the fourth book I wrote in my series on unintentional side effects, I knew from the beginning that this had to be about waste, because it's something that nobody wants, but it is necessarily produced. Keep in mind that if you only living as a human being or as some other animal produces waste. Walking makes you sweat, eating makes you having to defecate, and so on. So it's part and parcel of who we are, but we'd rather not think about it. So in the United States, people don't even go to the toilet, they go to the bathroom, right? Because you don't say toilet. It's almost like saying the N-word. But this dark secret is brought to light at the dump, as Chalfin says and shows. Because it's lifted out and it's being transformed into something which is, if not exactly pure, which is at least inside some of the range of human livelihoods. You can make a living of things that others have thrown away. And you can transform them into something valuable. And you don't have to wait for generations, as in the case of some of Michael Thompson's examples from rubbish theory. You can do it right now if you have the creativity and the wherewithal and the initiative to do it. So that here's a paradox, you know. We're fond of paradoxes, aren't we? Trash trashes the land at the same time as it provides subsistence. So it's ambiguous, you see. I've now been talking for about an hour altogether about the boundary, the frontier between that which is waste and that which isn't, rubbish and non-rubbish. I'm not saying that plastic in the ocean can easily be turned into a resource, but maybe if it's collected, and there are technologies afoot that seem to be able to at least collect some of that plastic, well, that can be recycled. I mean, turned into, I don't know, jackets. In the past, I would say CDs or CD covers, but people don't have CDs anymore, but other stuff that's made of plastic. So, but the point, and to return at the end of this lecture to overheating, the world as a closed system. That is one of the premises for the overheating perspective, because otherwise, I mean, if the world had been an open system, if there had been open frontiers, you know, the West had not yet been opened, as it were, and huge swathes of land in Russia and elsewhere, this wouldn't be an issue. There's a problem here of congestion, right? And that's why I thought this quotation from that guy, a worker at the toll booth in Aschheim and Temen, overhead bridge. That's why I thought that quotation was so good. It says, "We can't even breathe when we come to work." So this is, you know, suffocation. So the more we use, the more we produce, the more we must extract, the more we have to waste. Among your readings, probably Trawick and Hornburg are the ones who most sort of theoretically and lucidly and clearly describe this paradox. Except, of course, the overheating book, but never mind that. So on that note, I end, and I shall be seeing you again next week. So have a good day.